Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
Welcome, welcome. This is another one of these shows. We used to call them scrambles, the scramble. But that was in the old days, the before times. We don't really have a name for it yet. We've been calling it like the scrambly thing or something. And potpourri and smorgasbord, they just don't seem to work. So there's an ongoing contest with a prize of $10 million to come up with a new name for this show. But I have obviously a disincentive from anybody ever winning. I would have to pay them $10 million. All right, enough about that. It's time to get down to business, and business will include, a little bit later in the show, a conversation about how big companies without a lot of glamour appeal. I'm looking at you, Duncan, but I'm also looking at you, 7-Eleven and Cheetos and a whole bunch of other things, how they get you to actually buy merch, not the merch that they were selling you in the first place, like the coffee and the donuts, but like hoodies and bathrobes and stuff like that. How your lifestyle got blended into perhaps something it was never meant to be blended into, but you're doing it gleefully. And sometimes ironically. We'll also talk about something that has occupied our attentions in the past and probably will occupy our attentions in the future, the never-ending quest to bring back the woolly mammoth. But now it's like a startup. You know, they got money behind it. I don't know if that matters. It probably doesn't. All right, but we're going to begin where we often do begin, with the pandemic, very specifically. Well, first of all, today there's another grim milestone. One in 500 people in the United States have now died of COVID-19. It's not one in 10, but it's still a startling number. And one clinical professor of medicine, population, and public health sciences, Jeffrey Klausner, from the University of Southern California Keck School of Medicine, said, "We're kind of where we predicted we would be with completely uncontrolled spread of infection." So back when we were in the early days looking at curves, like what would happen? You know, what would happen if we didn't get a handle on this? Well, you know, that's one of the reasons that President Biden stepped forward last week with a bunch of mandates. And we're going to talk about those right now and talk about other strategies that may need to accompany a mandate with Debbie Kaminer, professor of law at the City University of New York's Baruch College. She joins us now. She wrote about this for one of our favorite online publications, The Conversation. Debbie Kaminer, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's begin maybe just by talking a little bit about what the president did that is a departure from what has been the case in the past. And in a way, to me, one of the interesting things and one of the key things is directing OSHA to begin some kind of rulemaking process, right? OSHA now has to promulgate some kind of guidelines, not just guidelines, but which they've already done. They've done guidelines. They're going to promulgate hard and fast rules for employers.
Right, that's correct. So essentially what President Biden's new mandate from last week was it was responding to the nearly 80 million vaccine eligible Americans who are, as of now, fully unvaccinated. So he promulgated these new vaccine mandates that are going to affect a total of about 100 million workers. Now, part of it covers federal employees and government contractors who have to be vaccinated. Part of it covers workers at healthcare facilities who get funding from Medicare and Medicaid who have to be vaccinated. And then you're absolutely right that the biggest part, which covers approximately 80 million workers, is asking OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, to develop rules that any company with 100 or more employees has to ensure that their workforce is either vaccinated or tested on a weekly basis. And what's really interesting about this OSHA rule is that under the normal process, an OSHA regulation could take years going through the normal notice and comment process to be promulgated. So this new OSHA rule is going to be imposed under what's known as an ETS or an emergency test standard. And this is what can be used when you have employees being exposed to some type of a grave danger from some new hazard. And it is not something that is used that often. And people are already claiming they're going to be challenging this new OSHA rule once it is promulgated.
Right. I mean, there's sort of a double edge to this in the sense that, yes, it's amazing that they can get this into effect so quickly as opposed to the normal duration that it takes for implementation. On the other hand, it's kind of amazing that with a new threat that has now killed one out of every 500 Americans, OSHA actually has never had anything that it could do that had about it that had any teeth in it beyond what already existed. In other words, OSHA already governs situations in which people have to be provided with PPEs, and you could fold COVID-19 into some of those things. But in terms of anything that directly addresses problems posed by this unique environmental threat, it's kind of amazing that we're just getting OSHA involved.
Yes, I agree with that. And I think the reason why OSHA is just getting involved at this point is there is not surprisingly a lot of pushback from OSHA being involved. And throughout the summer, the administration had been encouraging private businesses to, on their own, enact various vaccine mandates. I think this is really being used almost as a, you know, last shot type of thing for the very reason it will lead to pushback. And it seems that at this point, based on President Biden's speech, you know, as you pointed out, one in 500 Americans have been killed. You know, encouraging people is no longer sufficient.
So as we look at all of the things that you just described, all of the mandates and demands and requests made in this single motion by the Biden administration, let's sort of compare it with something that you've written about, which is this incredible, almost indecipherable patchwork, this maze, this labyrinth of different states with different rules and different companies with different rules, different entertainment venues with different rules, different educational institutions with different rules. I mean, it would be hard enough if there were just one entity, if the CDC was given absolute uninterruptible power over this whole situation, it would still be confusing because the biomedical understanding changes from month to month or 6 months to 6 months, and because you know the curves change and maybe require a different response. But it isn't just one entity; it's thousands of entities. And I'm wondering, to what degree will the federal action envisioned by the Biden administration sweep away some of that difficult to parse set of contradictions and put in kind of one set of rules?
Okay, so essentially what, you know, you've been referring to are the issues and the problems we have with federalism, with our system of government. The states, in a nutshell, are able to have stricter rules than the federal government has. So you can sort of think of it as the federal government is going to be the floor in all of this, but the states could still have stricter rules if they choose to do so. And then additionally, private businesses can do, you know, as long as they are not violating any types of anti-discrimination laws, private businesses have the right to have their own vaccine mandates. So I think sometimes it's easiest to think of it in terms of there's what the federal government does, there's what state and local government does, and then finally, private businesses have a vast amount of freedom to the extent that they're not violating any anti-discrimination laws to have whatever types of vaccine mandates they see fit in their workplaces.
Right. I mean, we would have to describe the approach to the pandemic in its first 19 months as anti-federalist. You know, I mean, basically, it's, you know, it's all over the map. So I'm also wondering, you kind of already have alluded to this, but another part of the announcement last week was the implication, let the lawsuits begin. Obviously, this is going to be challenged in court umpteen different ways. And I'm wondering, what kind of status do the mandates have prior to any effective court challenge against them? In other words, can people seek an injunction that stops the Biden mandates in their tracks, or do they go forward until they're overturned?
Well, they could seek an emergency injunction. For example, that's what happened with Indiana University had a vaccine mandate, mm-hmm. and there were 8 students who went to the United States Supreme Court. They asked for an emergency injunction to keep the Indiana University vaccine mandate from going into effect, and their request was denied. So you could, but it doesn't mean you're going to win.
Right. So another part of all this, so one of my sort of rules of public policy is don't make a policy you can't enforce. And I have questions about the ability to enforce this policy absent some kind of universally accepted standard of proof of vaccination. In other words, you can put in vaccine mandates, but then how do people prove that they're vaccinated? Well, we get these kind of wimpy little ballpoint cards, most of us, that really wouldn't. We couldn't get into a bar with the equivalent of that kind of ID proving our age. But somehow or other, with this life and death matter of whether we've been vaccinated, mostly, it varies from state to state once again, but mostly what we've got is this kind of wimpy looking little thing that you know really wouldn't even want to carry around in your wallet because it would disintegrate. So can we sort of discuss the case for some kind of standardized, not state by state vaccine passport, or maybe we need to find a less inflammatory term for that?
Right. Well, one thing which is interesting is I agree with you. I think the term vaccine passport ends up being very inflammatory. And I'm not really sure why, because all a vaccine passport is digital proof of vaccination. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is I'm in New York City. I work in New York City. And in New York City, if you want to go to a restaurant indoors, you have to show proof of vaccination. You can show just your vaccination card. So a surprisingly large number of people are carrying around their little disintegrating cards. Mm. So you sort of do have the proof of either using your card or using what's known as the Excelsior Pass, which is just proof of vaccination. I think that a lot of states might be very nervous about mandating proof of vaccination only through digital proof of vaccination, both because that could end up discriminating against people, you know, elderly people who might not be less likely to be comfortable with technology or have technology, or people who might not want to get a digital vaccine passport because they're concerned about privacy issues. So I certainly think that a digital vaccine passport, like what's being discussed in Connecticut and what's very similar to what we have in New York, could sort of streamline the process. I would be surprised if that was required as opposed to being an alternative to, you know, these pieces of paper with a proof of vaccination.
Right. So obviously this will be folded in to the politicization of everything else about this pandemic. So, yes, here in Connecticut, our governor has been kind of openly toying with and trial ballooning the idea of something resembling a vaccine passport or whatever else we're going to call it for a little while here. I'm just going to play you a clip right now of the Republican House Minority Leader Vincent Candelora reacting to that.
Having just gone to a game in Yankee Stadium a couple weeks ago, they said the rollout in New York was a complete disaster for them, and they moved away from it. So I went into the stadium without anybody asking me my vaccine status.
So there's a lot of interesting things about this in that those very few words. First of all, that his research about this issue was to go to a Yankees game, and then also that they were having trouble with it. I would assume one of the reasons they're having trouble with it is people from lots of different states show up at Yankees games and they don't all have the New York thing that would maybe allow them to be processed faster. In a way, Candelora is offering an argument for more vaccine passports that are easily recognizable by scanners or whatever you're going to use, right?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. It sounds like that's what he's doing. I myself have not been to a Yankees game, so I have no doubt that that may have been what's occurring. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is I have been to many restaurants in New York City since the New York rule went into effect. And because that is a smaller number of people, just, you know, anecdotally, every place I have been requires you to actually show you have been vaccinated, either a New York card or another state's card. But absolutely having a digital system would simplify, modernize the system and make things go much smoother.
Yeah, and it seems like otherwise. I mean, you guys in New York are in a different situation, but here in Connecticut, we've been effectively on the honor system. I mean, yes, we do have our little paper cards, but I mean, for the most part, we don't get asked for them, although that seems to be about to change. In the space of 24 hours, I got an email from the Jewish Community Center where I live and where there's a gym and stuff like that saying you're going to need proof of vaccination to get in here. And also from a local arts organization called Real Artways saying that for our creative cocktail hour, proof of vaccination. But, you know, once again, a lot of that has been so far on the honor system. You just had to affirm that you've been vaccinated. And it gets back to that whole question of what is proof of vaccination?
Right. And what you were also just describing is private businesses independently choosing that they want to mandate vaccination for their customers, which they, of course, have the right to do. And a private business would have the right to set up whatever kinds of vaccine, you know, mandates they would want to set up, unless it violated some other type of law. But one of the things you had mentioned earlier, which I thought was fascinating, was the whole idea of the politicization of all of this. That when you look at the vaccine mandates, about half of the states have some type of vaccine mandate, with the exception of Maryland, Massachusetts, and Vermont, which are led by Republicans, but have a very liberal-leaning population. Every other state with a vaccine mandate is being led by a Democratic governor. And then you have 20 states in the country which have actually passed laws prohibiting vaccine mandates. Every single one of those is being led by a Republican. So it is really pretty shocking when you look at the actual numbers, you know, on a state by state basis, what these states are doing.
Yeah, and it almost gets into sort of an area of opinion and language researchers like Frank Luntz, who a Republican researcher who has actually become quite concerned about the pandemic and how it's being discussed. And, you know, although I was a little bit unplugged last week, I was taking some time off when the Biden mandate came out, it seemed to me that the Republicans were able to shift the ground pretty quickly and talk about this as the heavy hand of government, the big hand of government, telling us what to do, superseding states' rights, all this kind of stuff. And that's why I began our conversation talking about OSHA. It seems to me that if Frank Luntz were advising the Biden administration, he'd kind of tell him to start there. This is for the worker. These are for the majority of workers are vaccinated. You know, they are concerned about the pandemic, and they really have previously had not much recourse if they felt as though they were in an unsafe situation, no matter what kind of business they worked in, and that this is delivering to the average person a tool to do something about an unsafe situation. And to me, it should be kind of marketed, if that's the right word, to the public as such. But I'd love your thoughts.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I actually think that in President Biden's speech, when he was talking about the vaccine mandate, he kept emphasizing the fact that the vast majority of Americans have received at least one shot, and that we are all being impacted by a minority who are refusing to be vaccinated. So I think he did a really good job of trying to sort of respond to that criticism of imposing things on the American people. And instead, you know, his whole idea was that what he's doing is supporting what the majority of Americans really do want.
Yeah. And I think also it seems as though he might be also giving some employers anyway an opportunity to kind of take themselves off the hook. I'm guessing most employers don't want COVID to rip through their workforce. I mean, all you have to do is look at, as long as we're talking about baseball teams, talk about the Boston Red Sox, who would have like seven players at a time out recently because of COVID-19 positive tests or direct exposures. Nobody wants that with their workforce, or very few people would be willing to tolerate it in return for other kinds of implicit freedoms. But now the employer can say, you know, I don't have much choice about this. I could get a $14,000 fine if I don't follow this policy. So that's why I'm doing it. I mean, I assume something like this does kind of give them a way to pass the responsibility elsewhere.
I agree with you 100%. I think one of the main, you know, President Biden throughout the summer had encouraged employers to do this. And when that didn't work, I think one of the main purposes behind this OSHA mandate is to sort of provide cover for employers so that they have a way of being able to mandate the vaccine. And I think even if, you know, the rule hasn't been promulgated yet, even if when the rule comes down, it is challenged, you know, by that point, companies may feel more comfortable saying, look, we had a vaccine mandate, you know, and it was required by OSHA. It worked out well. We are just going to be keeping it.
Sounds good to me. Debbie Kemener, a professor of law at the City University of New York's Baruch College, has a piece about this in The Conversation, which is a publication online that we recommend. Who's covered by a vaccine mandate? Here's a quick guide to America's patchwork of COVID-19 shot requirements. Thanks for talking to me.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. And we'll take a break, and we're going to put on our Dunkin' hoodie and our Cheetos pajamas. I guess maybe not in that order. I'm not sure. I'm very confused.
Was backstage in Pomona, and that's the way I like it. She drank beer with Coca-Cola, and that's the way I like it. And that's the way I like it. She told me about the winds from Santa Ana, and that's the way I like it. And that's the way I like it. She told me she loved me like fireworks, and that's the way I like it.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. The FDA has recently approved Zepbound, a new medication for chronic weight management. Dr. Davida Umashankar, Hartford HealthCare's System Medical Director of Medical Weight Loss, tells us more.
Zepbound helps decrease hunger and increase satiety levels. Taking this medication for 72 weeks, people can see at the highest dosage approximately 48 pounds of weight loss. So definitely a powerful drug and another powerful tool that we have to utilize to help individuals who struggle with obesity.
For those ready to explore their medical weight loss options, Dr. Umashankar has advice on the first most important step.
I don't think anyone knows you better than your own primary care physician. So having that conversation whenever you feel ready is so important, because these medications are quite powerful and do need to be monitored on a regular basis.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In Community Speaker Series, May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speaker-series.
We are back, and it's time for you to lift your sleepy head up off your McDonald's chicken nugget pillow and ignore that strange tingling going on inside your Tesla shorts and pull on your Dunkin' hoodie. And because we're going to talk about the fact that you are paying companies right now to wear what used to be considered promotional merchandise that they would try to get you to wear just so you could walk around advertising their brands. But now you are paying your hard-earned money to those companies. And a person who's done a good job of documenting and observing this phenomenon is Laura Kelly, a contributor to GQ. Her piece this week is Welcome to Dunkin' World. It focuses heavily but not exclusively on the phenomenon, particularly here in the Northeast, of Dunkin' doing seemingly successful limited edition merch drops. So first of all, welcome to our show and congratulations on this article, Laura Kelly.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So maybe we should explain to some of our less clued in listeners what a limited edition merch drop is.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So a limited edition merch drop is basically when a brand drops a limited amount of merchandise for a limited period of time. So it's something that really originated with the streetwear brand Supreme, and it's something that a lot of other streetwear brands have mimicked since, and in even more recent years, we have seen brands like Dunkin mimic it as well. So basically, a brand will announce that, you know, right now we have a limited amount of X item on our website. And if you happen to see the post, you can log on and buy it. And then when the time is up, it's gone and you can't get any more of the merch.
Yeah. So, I mean, I probably know this mainly through the world of sneakers, where Nike will put out a limited edition, certain kind of Michael Jordan type sneaker or something like that. That at least is kind of what Nike does anyway for a living, right? They make and sell sneakers. And you can say the same thing about, I don't know, FUBU or something. You know, I mean, the stuff that they would put out was the stuff that they make and sell anyway. So this is a little bit different, right? This is, we are now talking about, and it's not just Dunkin'. I discovered our technical producer, Kat Pastor, when the opportunity was presented to buy limited edition 7-Eleven merchandise. She seized that opportunity, possibly to her financial detriment, and bought pretty much anything she could get her hands on. And so, I mean, Laura, this is a little different, right? This is like companies, this isn't the stuff they do for a living. This is the stuff that you wear or use to signify that you buy the stuff they do for a living.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that you bring up sneakers. So Dunkin' in 2018 actually started dipping its toes into the world of branded merch with a pair of sneakers.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, thank you. No pun intended. But they found success with that. People were posting about it on social media and they were excited about it. So they have started releasing increasingly sort of off the rails swag since then. So you'll often see brands doing, yes, sneakers. Other merch you might expect to see are t-shirts or hoodies or sweatpants or sort of conventional merchandise. What's interesting about Dunkin's approach in particular is that they're doing sort of crazy zany items. So for example, they released a bridal collection. And someone I spoke to for my article got married in New Hampshire in July, and she actually was thrilled in advance of her wedding to purchase a limited edition Dunkin' bridal robe to get ready in with her bridesmaids. She got special Dunkin' tumblers for her wedding party to drink Dunkin' coffee from as they got ready. And she said that the only thing that she regretted about it was that Dunkin' didn't have bridal robes for the entire bridal party. So they've been doing all sorts of items like that. They've also done bathrobes. They've done bedding. They did like a tandem bike. And so I think with Dunkin's strategy, definitely part of it is getting people to go outside of the house in like a Dunkin' hoodie or something like that. But they also are interested, I think, in generating buzz on social media through having these sort of crazy items that you might post from home.
All right. Since you just said the words social media, we have to veer off and talk a little bit about how that was done. And I actually have a document issued by the government that says that because of my age, I do not have to understand Instagram influencers or know who they are. But you don't have that document. So you had to figure this out. And that led you to somebody that you probably already knew about named Charli D'Amelio. But you better tell our audience about Charli and what she had to do with all this.
Yeah, absolutely. So Charli D'Amelio is sort of known as the queen of TikTok. She has more than 124 million followers, and she's very, very influential on the platform. And so Charli has been a big fan of Dunkin' for a long time. And for a couple of years now, she's actually been posting herself with a giant iced coffee before she does one of her viral dances and that kind of thing. So Charli was posting without being paid by Dunkin' about Dunkin', and Dunkin' pretty quickly noticed that and started a partnership with her. So now she's like an official Dunkin' ambassador or partner, and she posts about the brand on her page. She does ads. She actually had a couple of special limited edition Dunkin' drinks. So they made a drink called the Charlie. And then in February, they made another drink called the Charlie Cold Foam, which was the same as the Charlie, but with cold foam on top. And you know, this is a really fun campaign. It's effectively reaching young people, but it also is, you know, kind of a savvy business move on Dunkin's part. A Dunkin' spokeswoman told me that within a few days of launching the Charlie, they sold hundreds of thousands of the drinks, and that the Charlie Cold Foam did even better. And the president of Dunkin' Americas actually boasted to shareholders in a meeting last year that the day of this launch, the app had its most users ever. So Dunkin' is definitely being strategic about generating buzz, specifically on TikTok. Dunkin' itself has millions of followers on the platform. They're doing some drops on the platform itself. So they like dropped a onesie on TikTok that sold out in 4 minutes. And so, yeah, they're definitely being very savvy and strategic. And just one more thing on this is that Charlie was a pretty savvy partnership for them to launch, because Gen Z is known to love authenticity. They're pretty savvy about when they're being marketed to. So I think it was really appealing that Charlie authentically liked Dunkin', was posting about it without being paid. And so people are pretty open to her posts, even though she now is paid to promote the brand.
Well, I'm so glad you brought up generations, because yeah, Gen Z, millennials, I think they have, I don't know. I mean, let's stipulate that the movie, The Trial of Chicago, The Chicago 7 or whatever it was called, that's, those were actually real people. I was alive when they were alive. Their whole attitude was F the corporations. I mean, it wouldn't occur to them to enthusiastically and unironically embrace the idea of running around in a Dunkin' shirt or a, you know, Cheetos, what, you know, I don't know, jogger or something. But there just seems to be a little bit more of a symbiotic and less adversarial relationship with the people who market things and the people who buy things that are marketed in the case of some of the younger generations. I don't know. Does that seem right to you?
Yeah, that's such an interesting point. I definitely think so. And I think, like I said, I think that it's important that Dunkin' was able to seem authentic and relatable. You know, Dunkin' itself, through sort of like just its longtime brand identity, is sort of known as like a normal brand, right? It's unpretentious. It's not frou-frou. You go there to sort of get a utility cup of coffee. The drink to get there is, you know, a regular coffee. And so I think that some people in Gen Z sort of have this attitude of they're going to be marketed to anyway. And it's way more fun if the brand is authentic and relatable and seems like something that real people like. For the article, I spoke with a Penn professor named Barbara Kahn, and one point that she made about Dunkin's strategy of appealing to Gen Z is that Gen Z loves community. And something like a drop is inherently creating a community, right? Because there's an in-group and an out-group. And so you're part of the in-group if you see the drop on Instagram or whatever and immediately get the stuff and then you post about it. And then if you don't, you're out of the group, and that sort of is what it is as well. So I think, yeah, to your question, if you're going to be marketed to anyway, I think it's appealing to be marketed to by a brand that's fun, that sort of speaks the language without trying too hard, which I think Dunkin' is doing a pretty good job of achieving.
Right. So there's this French brand researcher named Clotaire Rapaille, who would fit right into any of your future articles of this kind, who was a long, long time ago, at one point, he was hired by Nestle to introduce coffee to Japan, which eventually was done successfully. But Nestle couldn't do it at first. They couldn't get Japanese people to stop drinking tea and start drinking coffee. And as Rapaille researched this, he realized the Japanese people had no what he called code for coffee. Coffee didn't mean anything to them. It didn't mean coming home. It didn't mean a happy smell from childhood. It didn't mean anything. And so it was almost impossible to make commercials about it or market to them. And what he eventually convinced Nestle to do was to develop coffee flavored and coffee smelling desserts for children. So they'd get kind of get into it. And then as they got older, they'd buy coffee. Well, Dunkin' kind of did that organically, right? I think people, particularly, you know, Gen Z, millennial people, their code with Dunkin' is it's this wonderful donut I used to get. And then I got older and I started drinking coffee. And then I entered this life, first in college maybe, and then in the workforce, where I kind of needed a friend to help me keep going sometimes, particularly in a digitally demanding environment where it's hard to get away from your work. And that's when Dunkin' stepped in again. You know, I could get caffeine from them. I'm addicted, but in a good way. You know, it's sort of all kinds of pleasant associations that probably started with baby duck-like imprinting in childhood. It's no wonder people want to get some pajamas with this stuff on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Dunkin' has intentionally as a brand been trying to market especially sweeter drinks to young people. You mentioned the donuts, but additionally, they have these culotta drinks, which are basically sweet slushies. And the idea is like the whole family can come in and, you know, the adults can get coffee and the kids can get whatever sweet drink. One of the young people that I interviewed for this article, a young woman named Molly Gruber, who's actually a Dunkin' influencer on TikTok as well, said that she feels that her peers love Dunkin'. And one reason is because you can get really sweet drinks. It doesn't hurt that they're also more affordable than somewhere like Starbucks, which has a little bit of a higher price point. But I think just frankly, like the very sweet syrups and things like that are appealing to young people. Even if they are drinking coffee, you know, it's a little more approachable than a black coffee or something like that.
Right. And you are, for that reason, you are sort of shouting out your, I mean, as you said, these generations don't like to be artificially marketed to by, say, Instagram influencers who are just getting paid to do it. It's got to feel organic. It's got to feel real on that end, but it's got to feel real on their end too. You know, in other words, they want to have a Dunkin' bathrobe because they really like these products and they've enjoyed them for a long time and it's meaningful to them. So, yeah. So that's why it's happening. Congratulations, Dunkin'. If anybody wants to do Christmas shopping for Kat Pastor, she does want Cheetos merch, right? That's what you want, right? Cheetos merch. That's coming next. And there are those pajamas that you sent me a picture of? What are those? A sweatsuit. She would like the Cheetos sweatsuit, and she would like it unironically given. Well, listen, this has been so much fun to talk about. And so thank you so much for writing such an interesting article, Laura Kelly.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great to talk to you.
All right. The piece is in GQ. It's called Welcome to Dunkin' World. You were living in it already. You just didn't know. I added that subtitle. All right. So meanwhile, we're going to go to a break. Practice your woolly mammoth calls. Like that. That's a woolly mammoth call. Because we're going to get woolly mammoths back, I promise. All right, here mammoth, here woolly. You just have to learn how to do that. And then they'll come, you know, running across the Siberian tundra towards you, but not quite yet. And we'll explain that in just a second. But first, I have to thank Kat Pastor, who is not wearing Cheeto sweatsuits today, but hopes to be in the near future. Technical producer and episode producer, the great Jonathan McPants. Now we are going to talk, in fact, about the woolly mammoth to Carl Zimmer, the science columnist for the New York Times. His newest book is Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. We did a whole show about that with him, but he's back to talk about the news. So, Carl, first of all, welcome back to our show.
Thanks for having me.
And the news is not they're going to try to bring back the woolly mammoth, because that's been going on for almost 10 years now, if not longer. The news, I think, is that there's sort of startup money being pushed into it, right?
This has been a dream of some scientists for going on a decade now. But what's happened as of now, as of in the past few days, is that there's actually a company that has been formed with $15 million of initial seed round funding.
And there's some fancy names that have floated around this project. Peter Thiel, not always beloved and embraced by all of us. The Winklevoss twins, you loved them in The Social Network. I mean, some of the sort of big names of startup capital have been sniffing around at this.
Well, you know, Peter Thiel gave the lead scientist on this project, George Church of Harvard, $100,000 a few years ago. Basically, they were sitting around and Thiel said, "What's your craziest project you're working on?" And Church said, "I'd like to essentially bring back the woolly mammoth." And so he just, you know, wrote a check. So, you know, these are not just people who do a lot of startup investing, these are people with a lot of money. And, you know, this is the kind of research that, you know, cautious government funders might be leery of. You know, they might not think that this might be the best use of taxpayer dollars. And so, you know, it's been sort of eking along on a shoestring budget until now, but now there's some fairly serious money behind it.
Right. I feel like that should almost replace, you know, the term FU money. You know, how much money do I have? I've got woolly mammoth money. I can afford to put money into bringing back the woolly mammoth. And I think that's especially true because, Carl, reading your article, it seems like we're not on the brink of getting woolly mammoths back. Quite the opposite. Some of the most basic problems have not been solved.
Yeah, this is... this is, I would say, a dream. This is, but, you know, realities come out of dreams. And so, you know, there are things that seemed impossible when this dream began almost a decade ago that have already been achieved. I mean, they have already done some things, like, for example, figure out certain key genes that woolly mammoths had, insert those into cells to kind of understand how they might have worked. Like, they are making steps towards this goal, but there are many, many more steps until they might reach it, and no one knows if they'll ever achieve it.
And it isn't really sort of inventing or reinventing a woolly mammoth ab ovum so much as it is adapting things about the elephant to make them more woolly mammoth-like. Is that a fair statement?
That's correct. So it's not like someone's going to take a frozen woolly mammoth and put it in the microwave and then something comes shambling out of the microwave. This is not Jurassic Park where you have like exact replicas of things that were around long ago. Essentially what this is genetically engineering an elephant with some of the traits that woolly mammoths had. That's the idea. So, you know, you could think of it as a mammoth-like elephant or a mammoth-elephant hybrid, whatever you want to think about. I mean, but no, it won't be, you know, an exact replica of the woolly mammoths that went extinct some thousands of years ago.
Right. Since you mentioned Jurassic Park, let's hear an appropriate warning about this.
Don't you see the danger, John, inherent? In what you're doing here, genetic power is the most awesome force the planet's ever seen, but you wield it like a kid that's found his dad's gun. This isn't some species that was obliterated by deforestation or the building of a dam. Dinosaurs had their shot, and nature selected them for extinction.
I simply don't understand this Luddite attitude, especially from a scientist. I mean, how can we stand in the light of discovery and not?
Oh, what's so great about discovery? It's a violent, penetrative act that scars what it explores, what you call discovery. I call the rape of the natural world.
Dinosaurs and man, two species separated by 65 million years of evolution, have just been suddenly thrown back into the mix together. How can we possibly have the slightest idea of what to expect?
Well, you ignore the warnings of Jeff Goldblum always at your peril, and certainly there. And I mean, it really does bring up some fair questions, including, I mean, the idea is to, if you could get a bunch of these sort of woolly mammoth 2 models, to release them on the Siberian tundra. And it is fair to ask, isn't it? What could go wrong?
You know, whenever you introduce a species, you should be asking, well, what could go wrong? What are the risks? But also, what are the benefits? I'm a little unclear on why, when everybody talks about Jurassic Park, what exactly woolly mammoths have to do with velociraptors?
Fair enough.
What's the that source of terror from a movie? I'll point out. I'm not sure how relevant that is to deciding whether this is a good idea or not. And that's certainly like a subject of fierce debate among conservation biologists, among ethicists, and so on. Like, that is a completely valid debate. But to, you know, quote a fictional character talking about a fictional process involving things that were extinct 65 million years ago is, it's odd, I'd say. I find it, I mean, I've been writing about this whole de-extinction idea for about 8 years. I wrote about it first in National Geographic, and everyone just brings up Jurassic Park as if that settles it. And I came up to saying, like, well, that was a movie, all right? Like, that never happened. I mean, we can talk about cane toads in Australia, for example. Then I'm all ears. Like, yes, you introduce a species and bad things may happen. On the other hand, in terms of genetic tinkering, well, like, you know, the corn that you eat, the yogurt that you eat, I mean, like, we're dealing with all sorts of things that are the product of genetic alteration. So, you know, we shouldn't be naive about this process either.
Although
there's a lot to discuss, yeah. But I think we can leave the dinosaurs out. That's all I'm saying.
Yes. Well, now I feel really predictable, but that's okay. I'm glad
you brought it up so we could like talk about it, because like, you know, it is something. I mean, you should see my Twitter feed. It's just full of juice of Jeff Goldblum right now. Yeah.
Well, I mean, so is everybody else's, but for different reasons. But isn't part of the argument being bodied forth here for this, or for maybe trying this, is that woolly mammoths, if you did put them out in Siberia, would somewhat transform the environment, maybe back to a state that they transformed it to back in the old days, and maybe even do things that would ameliorate the climate crisis we're having right now. I mean, some of the stuff that was described, I didn't really get. Like, I thought moss was really good. It was a really good carbon sink, and the woolly mammoths would just tear up all the moss but put something else back in there. I mean, there's an argument being made, not that this would have no impact, but that it would have a good impact.
Yes. The argument that people are putting forward for the value of doing this is that in a place like Siberia, up until 10,000 years ago, there were woolly mammoths there who, it has been argued, were acting like ecosystem engineers. And so they were essentially like maintaining a grassland, and grasslands can store huge amounts of carbon. They're very resistant to erosion. They're very healthy ecosystems. And once mammoths and other big mammals disappeared, possibly due to, in part, to human hunting. So we played a part in this. These ecosystems changed. And now you had a tundra that was dominated by moss and by some shrubs and trees. And this ecosystem now is actually losing carbon. It's melting away. It's eroding. It's unstable. And so there have been ecologists, particularly a team of Russian ecologists, who said, we need to do everything we can to bring back that grassland, that because, you know, there's huge amounts of carbon locked up in the tundra. We don't want to let it go.
So we have time for one last question, and it's there in your article. This the company is called Colossal, and you say, and Colossal's investors may have to have questions of their own. How will these I can't even say it without laughing. How will these mammoths make money? So what is the answer to that question?
Well, I mean, I have not gotten any precise answers, but, you know, but the fact is that all the steps that you might take to try to in effect, bring back a woolly mammoth, there are all sorts of applications to those tools that you could envision. You know, so for example, there's a lot of genome sequencing from fossils and genome analysis and so on. These kinds of computational tools could be really important potentially for example, understanding human health and medicine. If you're trying to figure out how to produce these embryos that are essentially sort of mammoth-like elephants, there's a whole lot of reproductive technology that's going to go into that. Could that be used, for example, for producing new kinds of livestock? Maybe. We don't know. But there are a lot of steps along the way where an argument might be made that, you know, the basic research in the past has spun off all sorts of important applications. And certainly George Church, who's leading this, has a whole string of patents and companies behind him, largely involved with genomics and medicine and so on. So so it's not out of the realm of possibility that they may make a little money back. We'll
right.
see.
It's a little like the space program throwing off Tang and Teflon, whatever else they came up with. All right. Well, first of all, let me just tell you, part of the answer to the question is they'll hybridize them down to this roughly the size of a Newfoundland, and you'll have woolly mammoth, miniature woolly mammoth house pets, and then you'll have to have mammoth chow and mammoth beds, and Chewy.com will be selling all this stuff. And a lot of people make a lot of money. And that's how it all happened. But it's not going to happen anytime soon, but we do recommend that you read the article by our excellent and very welcome guest, Carl Zimmer, the science columnist for The New York Times. His newest book is Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. And this article is a new company with a wild mission. Bring back the woolly mammoth. Thanks for doing this, Carl.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening today. Don't forget at all that we still need a new name for this kind of show. Either that or we have to stop doing it. That's another option we have for these kind of, you know, potpourri kind of things. Anyway, thanks for listening.
We started out with five.